Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Aparna Gopalan, and today I will be speaking with Professor Dia Da Costa, author of the book Politicizing Creative Economy, Activism and a Hunger Called Theater, which came out with the University of Illinois Press in 2016. The book takes up the question of how, in a world where heritage, culture, creativity, and the capacity to imagine are themselves commodified, can art be harnessed for anti-capitalist agendas? At a time when scholars along all points of the political spectrum seem to agree that expressing their creativity is good for oppressed groups, whether because it makes them entrepreneurial or because it is an inherent challenge to capitalism, Dia Da Costa offers a refreshingly nuanced perspective on the dangers that creative economy discourses pose for radical activism. In her multi-sided ethnography, focusing on two activist theater troupes in the Indian cities of Delhi and Ahmedabad, Da Costa shows how these theaters of the oppressed exist alongside, fall prey to, reappropriate, and jostle with capitalist discourses and definitions of creative economy, which seek to contain and tame the cultural production of oppressed groups. The first troupe Da Costa discusses is the Jan Natya Manch, a communist-affiliated theatre group consisting mainly of middle-class activists who valorize Delhi's factory working class, albeit in a rapidly deindustrializing city, and offer a disenchanted secular critique of Hindu nationalism, albeit in a deeply religious milieu. The second troupe featured is Ahmedabad's Budhan Theatre, run by the lowly and criminalized Chara caste, who hope that through theatre they can craft respectable livelihoods and achieve inclusion as citizens, while at the same time critiquing the violences of the Indian capitalist state. By analyzing the possibilities and shortcomings inherent in both troops' practices and political approaches, Da Costa shows how carefully and critically studying the diversity of left politics is an important part of building solidarities, which can ultimately resist fascist neoliberalism. Da Costa also shows how attending to the politics of affect and emotion can help create successful social mobilization. Rather than simply lamenting how oppressed people don't rise up, attention to affective politics can help us shape forms of activism which actually speak to people's lives, hopes, and hungers. This book will be of interest to activists, radical educators, and scholars in fields ranging from feminist affect theory to development studies. I had the pleasure of speaking with Dia just a few minutes before. Here is the interview. I have with me today Professor Dia Da Costa, the author of Politicizing Creative Economy. Welcome to the show, Dia.
Thank you, Aparna.
So as we begin, I would like to know a little bit more about your very interesting and interdisciplinary background and set of interests. So could you tell us a bit about how you came to be a sociologist of development and education and all the other various things that you are?
Okay, yes, sure. I do think of my research as quite interdisciplinary. I would say, however, that I'm kind of trained in various forms of critical social theory and sociology, across three continents. And I think what makes it interdisciplinary is that sociology on three different continents is thought about very differently. And so the histories of the discipline are quite varied. And so I grew up in India, and I did my undergraduate in sociology in India, which is a combination of British sociology and anthropology. And then I went to the UK, University of Warwick, for a sociology of education, and subsequently to Cornell University for a degree in development sociology, which really was about critical development studies. And initially, I would say I embarked on my education abroad, driven by a colonial idea that it would allow me to bring home better ideas for development. And really, my critical development studies work, my education at Cornell made me recognize that this quest was a colonial one, and that it feeds certain kinds of dominant structures within the national context. And this was also, of course, the time that subaltern studies was a very popular school of thought. And so that certainly fed it as well. And so I was very fortunate to have teachers who were drawing attention to those kinds of literatures, but also giving me a much stronger sense of Marxian political economy in relation to subaltern studies. And so methodologically, my work has been oriented to thinking about development and globalization and colonial capitalism in intersectional and transnational ways, drawing on these kinds of literatures. But also, I would say, from a feminist lens, being invested in kind of directly probing one's own history of privilege. And that is something that has kind of grown more recently. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you. And I'm also interested in knowing how you came to write this particular book, because it seems like in the past, in your first book, Development Dramas, you focused much more squarely on development in Eastern India. And in this book, you seem to have moved to Delhi and Ahmedabad and to focus on a different set of theater troupes. So, what brought you to the conceptual apparatus and arguments in this book, and also what brought you to, you know, the locations?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for that question. So I was keen on thinking about West Bengal for my first book and for my dissertation because, well, partly just logistically, I speak Bengali and I'm from West Bengal. So, and I was keen to think about that. And I happened to find out that there was a theater troupe among agricultural workers that was using what seemed to me to be a participatory theater method. And this is, again, a time in the 1990s where participatory methods were becoming extremely popular. And so I was very keen to find out more, particularly about West Bengal, because it's the longest democratically elected communist government at that point. And yet what I found was that agricultural workers in West Bengal were nonetheless deeply classist and patriarchal. And so there they had kind of thought about other ways of thinking about and communicating their constructions of development and knowledge production and democracy with the theater of the oppressed methods. And that was very interesting to me, and it was interesting that they were using a technique like this to think about things like gender justice or livelihoods or, you know, right to small farmer agrarian futures, because of the way in which the leftist government still had a certain understanding of modernization and development that they were attached to. But there were also some deep kind of absences in development dramas, particularly, for example, how caste shapes development politics. I didn't attend to that at all. There was also, I would say, you know, the way in which most elite or most, I should not elite, but most middle class people are socialized against a leftist politics. And my kind of family construction, I wouldn't say is exactly that, but it was very sort of ambivalent about the West Bengal government. And in my socialization. So combined with my own neglect of the caste issues, I was finishing up development dramas around the time that Tata moved its plans for the nano car production from West Bengal to Gujarat. In that context, I could certainly explain how a communist-led government was still kind of entangled in capitalist accumulation and development that's kind of based on dispossession, but I couldn't quite explain or didn't really understand this kind of corporate alignment with the Hindu right. And so for me, the natural context to think about that was Gujarat, because my kind of, excuse me, my I would say my political coming of age, so to speak, or my coming of age anyway, was because it was in the 1990s, Babri Masjid was huge. It was really huge for me. I was actually on a train leaving Bombay in December 1992. And so I had a pretty visceral experience of that moment. And so it had always been something very important to the puzzle of what is this country that I live in, you know. I didn't have a way of understanding. At that time, I had the experience. I was appalled by certain things. I myself participated in a certain kind of thinking that violated my own understanding of, oh, India is secular. But I had not yet understood that Indian secularism was part of India's state project of, say, Hindu supremacy and violence, right? Likewise, with regard to development, I saw poverty all around me. Neoliberalism and, you know, the liberalization in the 1990s also shaped me a lot. But I hadn't quite learned how to think about inequality rather than poverty. So these kinds of things had remained questions for me. And so when 2002 happened, the pogrom against Muslims in Gujarat, and then, you know, combined with this kind of huge success of the Gujarat model, these things were kind of coming together for me. And so it was not enough for me to have an understanding of a critique of West Bengal. And I was generally interested in what's going on with the organized left. How can it be better? What are the problems? What are the issues? And then that led me to really try to understand better what are the dominant ways in which development discourses kind of gain traction within the context of regional histories of caste, of colonialism, but like regional histories, if that makes sense. I know I'm going all over the place here, but really what I'm trying to say is that going from development dramas to politicizing creative economy was my effort to understand various articulations of alternative constructions of development in relation to a statist construction of development.
Yeah, that actually does make sense. And one of the things I really appreciated about your book when I first, you know, got it and I was looking through it, was that you have a preface in which you basically ask the question that sometimes haunts us, those of us who, you know, are writing from the left, within the left, and yet critiquing parts of the left project. And you kind of very head on tackle that problem. And you ask, you know, what is at stake in what might seem like nitpicking at the left when there's the right rise of the Hindu right and the neoliberal, you know, fascist right across the world. I think that's a question that has troubled me in the past as well. And I really love how you answered it, where you basically said that that's where, you know, a sort of self-censorship begins, which makes it then difficult to distinguish between left and right in any kind of straightforward way. Or and basically you highlighted the how important it is that we don't stop the critique at a certain point where we find a project to be, you know, politically better. I guess that kind of your statement against the lesser evilism that, you know, we see a lot was really powerful, and I really appreciated that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, it's been something that I've struggled to understand in my, you know, what is our political coming of age? You know, it's like an ongoing process, but it's just something that I think nitpicking has been kind of a crucial way of learning for me, and it actually does connect to the way in which I was trying to intervene in understanding theories of affect and actually, you know, ground. So I was, methodologically speaking, I was trying to ground trajectories of global discourses, in this case, creative economy, in national and regional structures and histories of violence that give them traction. And one of the things that I wanted to make a case for was that the theories of affect that I was reading coming out of North America were quite disembodied, despite being rooted in feminist genealogies of knowledge production and so forth. They were not grounded in local histories. Their power seemed to be precisely that they were not sort of ideologically rooted and rootable and so forth. And I found this very, very troubling. And I found it almost anti-methodological. And I wanted to make a case for a very situated and embodied approach to thinking about affect. And for me, nonetheless, I wanted to make an argument that what I kept hearing people say around, you know, that they have a hunger for theater, I wanted to take that seriously. You know, rather than say that, oh, what does it mean to have a hunger for theater by people who are already so marginalized? I think it means that they're talking about a hunger for allowing their political vision, which is materially rooted, to matter, you know. And I think to not give that its due and to treat it as somehow lesser than does not recognize the ways in which these, you know, materiality is a complex thing, and I think there is something to visceral materialism. And so I really felt that there was something to affect theories in terms of being able to get at a kind of radical performativity, or, you know, the importance of the serendipitous potential of life in ways that exceed, say, social reproduction ideas. And but at the same time, there was also something important about affect that I wanted to say had to do with studying the serendipitous, or what feels like an epiphany, and thinking about the ways in which those who are experiencing those epiphanies, that there are structures and histories in place that effectively disseminate the work of affect in accomplishing certain kinds of ideological and discursive regimes. And if we don't pay attention to those histories, that's a problem. And the reason why I'm giving you this theoretical and methodological piece is because I think for me, something like thinking about Janam's work, I was deeply drawn to their work initially. And I remain drawn to their work in many ways. But, you know, I first met Janam around 2004, and this is after the Gujarat genocide. It's after George Bush won re-election in 2004. It's around that same time. And their capacity for satire and caricature is great. They caricatured the Hindu right. They had conviction in their voice. They had a fierce critique of capital, and it seemed like a gift to me at that time, at times that I felt so demoralized. But so affect theories and thinking about affect in grounded historical ways allowed me to recognize that the kind of depressing violence of our times made my capacity to attach myself to Janam with hope. You know, that kind of nostalgia, what I feel is partly nostalgia, seemed like hope to me at the time. And that has partly to do with the historical moment within which I encountered their work most deeply. And so I feel like it is actually really crucial to subject our feelings to scrutiny through contextualization and historical analysis, and ask, you know, which of their plays makes me cringe, which one gives me goosebumps, why, when am I, you know, moved to tears, and when am I not, when am I like, oh gosh, that's too melodramatic, or whatever, right? To actually nitpick about these kinds of feelings and un- the uneven feelings among us. Why does someone else respond differently to the same play or to the same sentence? That matters. And if we don't nitpick about that, I think we're missing a lot. And it's not just like some kind of thing where, you know, I'm navel-gazing on my feelings. It's more that I really do believe that the way in which middle classes are seduced into believing this comforting thing that, oh, there is a transgressive and transformative politics that's possible. I believe that that can be part of the structural reproduction of Hindutva and colonial capitalist ideology. And so that's why I think it's particularly crucial for middle classes to subject their feelings to scrutiny, because I think our feelings are very much tied to the structural reproduction of caste violence, Hindutva, colonial capitalist ideology, because what we feel is a pretty good gauge on the pulse of some of these ideologies and violences, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I also think that I also, the other thing I really appreciated, which came through a little in what you were saying now, is the way in which you refused to take creativity as something that's in itself emancipatory, which is a tendency we sometimes see in scholarship, is to say, okay, there's all these violent structures, there's Hindutva, you know, there's neoliberalism, and then creativity kind of stands outside of them as some other, and even culture and agency, all these things kind of stand outside of these large structures as if they're always inherently resisting, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the case, as you begin to show. So I think that was also another really important thing that you brought up. But just in terms of locating us in the kinds of things you're looking at, I was really interested in the way the book began. It began with this kind of story of there's this colony of performers in Delhi called the Kathputli colony. And you tell us that these performers have long been heralded as the bearers of India's creative economy or India's culture. And at the same time, they are now being displaced from this colony, which is seen as this kind of dirty slum. And it needs to, you know, make way for Delhi to become a world-class city. So this I found to be a very interesting example of the way in which these performers, you know, are both wanted and not wanted. And could you tell us a bit more about how kind of this kind of thing that you observed can help us understand what is meant by creative economy? And in what ways is it, you know, depoliticized perhaps? And then what goes into politicizing it?
One of the things I'm going to connect, so the Kathputli colony, I started with that example, even though the book is not necessarily focused on that, because I think it's a really succinct example of how some of this works, is that here's a group of people who have moved into the Delhi context in the 1950s. They helped clear the dense jungle. They helped build the place. But they are treated as a slum, and then now they are being displaced so that there can be a skyscraper, which the Delhi municipal government claims will be a skyscraper for the poor, kind of thing, right? That if they will also, the Kathputli colony people will also get part of the housing, part of their housing will be in there. So it's an advancement, it's progress, it's development for the poor, right? Whereas it really erases the fact that puppeteers, magicians, fire breathers, acrobats, jugglers, which is what this a community of people in Kathputli colony, that's part of their trade. Maybe a skyscraper isn't exactly the kind of environment that they need. They need a different structure, a spatial structure, right, of living, of residence, that they have built. And that rather than, so there's a certain kind of state violence that simultaneously displaces them by putting them into an environment that is assumed to be better, a skyscraper, whilst at the same time championing their cultural production, but misrecognizing that they're actually taking away their means of cultural production by reorganizing their space from what it is to what is presumed to be more advanced and developed kind of residence. So this is exactly what the creative economy kind of more broadly tends to do, is that it highlights certain aspects that are considered aesthetically pleasing and aesthetically sanitized and acceptable and modern, and displaces other kind of, displaces the very memories, customs, cultures that it is trying to capitalize on at the same time, right? So I'm interested in this double kind of process of what the state is doing is not just saying that, oh, I was also trying to critique this idea that somehow this state version of creative economy is depoliticized, and the one that Janam and Budhan Theatre are involved in is politicized. I think it's important not to do that. I think it's important to recognize how much collaboration, how much collective energy, how much political work goes into the production of the state versions of creative economy discourse and how deeply rooted they are in political histories. I think part of my effort was to demonstrate that, to show that creative economy, which is to say the construction of the economy based on cultural production, but a claim that cultural production can generate revenue, right, that for the state, and that it can be a feasible development option, which is the UN's terms for it, post-financial crisis of 2008. So these are the things that I think need to be kind of recognized, that you know, for example, Montek Singh Ahluwalia, and, you know, claim that this is the next big idea, is the creative economy is the next big idea, by which he's basically getting at the fact that we have a huge surplus population, about 20%, and the creative sector, this is also Rajiv Sethi's claim, who's like this cultural impresario who was in cahoots with Montek Singh Ahluwalia in this planning process, and basically argued that the creative economy, the creative sector, can absorb the population that has been rendered surplus in the agrarian sector, right? So the idea is that this 20% of India's 1.1 billion can be absorbed by the creative economy. This is like, so India's cultural competitive advantage are the surplus population's memories, customs, creative capacities, individuality. So this is a very specific kind of rooting of capital in cultural production. There has always been this, we know this, right? In the colonial context, they've always used culture in certain ways. They've also censored culture in certain ways. In the national development, 1950s, 60s, this took a different form, and I make the argument about this in the first chapter, around how they were, you know, the artisanal poor were considered victims of national industrial development. They're going to be hurt by them. So, you know, folk production, folk ways are dying, folk cultural production is dying. So it was always constructed as they're the victims and we need to save them. And so cultural production becomes part of the economy in that sense of like, let's save them and then let's sell what the artisanal poor produce to and make it part of the national economy and national development process so that they're not entirely trampled upon by this process of development and modernization. The neoliberal context and the Hindutva context in collaboration is a different thing, because now it's like artisanal poor are not victims. They must be seen as entrepreneurs, because they are actually going to sort of, they have a right to, they have a right to turn into property and revenue their memories, their customs, their cultural practices, and they have a right to sort of become entrepreneurs of that. And so it's a different kind of super optimistic mode of approaching the contributions of the artisanal poor. So I really think it's important to think about the different kinds of political work that is being done in both cases by state violence to incorporate the creativity of the caste poor, of the indigenous poor, and so forth in the state development process in a context of
where, you know, liberalization's effects have clearly been felt in terms of agrarian distress and so forth, and unemployment and so forth, and hunger. Where you're basically saying you can eat heritage and make money out of it. Right.
And I think that's the thing that you really, that really comes forth when you talk about, you know, how the same people who are celebrated are also these kinds of urban nuisances who need to be cleared out. That really shows us the kind of double standard that is inherent in picking out one aspect of the lives of the poor, which is their creativity, and trying to get them to leverage that, while at the same time, you know, destroying and attacking all the other aspects of their life, namely, you know, the material conditions of their existence. And so I think that you do a really good job kind of showing us what's the problem with both the narrative of the poor as victims, but also of them as entrepreneurs, which is kind of the thing that has taken off recently. And especially when you discuss the two activist theater groups that you discuss in the book, we start to see, you know, other ways of understanding performance, which are not premised upon entrepreneurship or this kind of globally circulating creative economy discourse. So just to orient our listeners, could you tell us a bit about each of the two troupes that you worked with, and just about, you know, who are the members, what kinds of messages are they putting out, and which audiences are they trying to reach?
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. So Jananatya Manch, or Janam, which is their acronym, they're one of the most widely known street theater troupes in India, I would say. They began in, you know, they came into being in the 1970s in the aftermath of, well, they consolidated their work in the aftermath of the emergency. And they have always, they're seen as the cultural wing of the Communist Party, Communist Party of India, Marxists, so CPM, and they are aligned with them. They have members who are long-standing members of the Communist Party of India, and their work has been oriented to highlighting always the critique of capitalism, and highlighting the ways in which national development politics and processes need an analysis of capitalism within it. And so they work a lot with trade unions, C2, so Center of Indian Trade Unions, and they work in alignment. So they go to factories and they perform in factories, and they go to working class neighborhoods and perform there. They go to university campuses and perform there. So, and to just bus stops and streets and so forth. So they perform to these kinds of contexts, driven by this need to keep alive a critique of capitalism within the Indian context. And they've done that since the 70s in this incredibly systematic way. Also their one of their co-founders, Safdar Hashmi, was killed in the course of a performance by Congress Party goons, and, you know, 4 days or 3 days later, they came back and finished, you know, did that performance again, and they haven't stopped since, right? So there's a certain kind of aura and iconic story that has been very, very much part of not only Janam's identity, but their politics, right? They are driven by a conviction that you cannot stop our performance, you cannot stop our critique of capitalism, and we believe in a critique of capitalism, and nothing is going to stop us from that. And they have enacted that through time. And, you know, that is a very powerful thing for people to witness. So that's Janam. And they have more recently started promoting kind of working class heritage walks and museums and concerts and so forth, which I believe is tied to the shifting spatial realities in the Delhi context around, you know, the closure to some degree of factories, and the decentralization of factory production that happened with liberalization. And they have been very keen on simultaneously maintaining a very, what's the word I'm thinking of? So they've been very keen to continue to press certain kind of politics and vocabulary, right? So even as workers use different kind of vocabulary for themselves, because they now see, you know, management as management, Janam in their plays choose to use an older vocabulary of, you know, owners and capitalists and so forth. So even as workers are moving towards more of a neoliberal kind of vocabulary, Janam has been very clear on what kind of vocabulary it wants to continue to use to have their performance remain political as they see it. But by the same token, though, they have been very keen on building these kinds of institutionalized forms of memory of working class history and politics. I think it's probably aligned with the same kind of politics that we must remember what working class politics has given us and what it has done and so on and so forth. But the trouble with that, of course, is that it is actually very much aligned with a lot of creative economy, dominant creative economy politics, with cultural districts coming up all over the place, many of which have working class museums in precisely the places where manufacturing is no longer a site of, you know, producing value, but culture is, right? So I think there's that piece in Janam's work. Budhan Theatre is the theatre troupe of an urban indigenous group called the Chhara, in the context of Ahmedabad, which is the capital of Gujarat, which was one of the key laboratories of the formation of violent Hindu fundamentalism in the Indian context. And Budhan Theatre is, historically, the Chhara were designated, they were one of over like 180 odd communities that were labeled as criminal tribes by British law, by the 1871 Act, Criminal Tribes Act. And they in 1952, they were denotified by the Indian government. So 5 years after Indian independence in 1947, in 1952, Nehru liberated them from this legal designation as criminal tribes, but they quickly found themselves on the habitual offenders list. So really, post-colonial law kind of reproduced the terms of colonial law, and even in police manuals to this day, they're known as born criminals. So there, they continue to deal with the stigma of this kind of colonial law. And their trades and their sort of skills have been in performance, in thievery for some of them, and in over, I mean, depending on which of these tribes you focus on, there are a range of different livelihoods. But Chhara histories do have to do with both thievery as well as performance. And so, what Budhan Theatre is doing in contemporary Gujarat is reclaiming that performance history as part of the present, so that they can get away from their ongoing stigma of being seen as criminal and having criminal livelihoods. So they live in Charanagar, which is seen as this den of vice, and, you know, they produce, say, some 80% of people there produce liquor in a dry state. Gujarat is a dry state, so by default their livelihood is illegal. Many of them participate in thievery, and so of course that's illegal in the context of private property laws and so forth. So Budhan Theatre's attachment, you would think, to creative economy discourses would be much more obvious, because they are craving mainstream belonging. They want to be seen as something other than criminal, and being part of legitimate cultural production, you know, legitimized by the state, I mean, and state policy, and cultural production by the poor, you would think that that is an ideal alignment for them. And it is. It's not that they don't in some ways gravitate towards it, but they also critique it. Not directly, but they, just as they critique colonial capitalist state, they also critique sites of performance. So I find them much more directly critical of the ways in which power informs performance spaces itself and their own spaces than Janam is. Janam is less internally critical in terms of its public performances of its work. So that, I would say, is one of the key differences, and I think that that's a very important one, especially when you think back to what I said about, you know, why should we nitpick about the internal differences among us? Well, because it matters, because we are different within, and because we cannot build a understanding of solidarity or a solidarity politics among the left without nitpicking and understanding the value of the differences among us.
Yes, thank you for that. And I actually, the next thing I'm going to kind of talk about is very much related to how you've ended. So as I was trying to process the takeaways from the book, you know, one thing that I started thinking about, or one way of, you know, understanding the takeaways, I thought that, and you can kind of tell me if this is near the mark or expand upon this or disagree with it, but it seemed like what you're arguing was that Janam and Budhan Theatre are offering two different ways of resisting. In the case of Janam, the method of resistance is kind of driven by a strict, you know, ideology, which is kind of this anti-capitalist ideology, and while that's their strength, that's also their danger, because that makes Janam be relatively more blind to caste and religion-based oppressions in favor of like a strict kind of working class valorization. And on the other hand, Budhan Theatre's form of resistance is one in which, you know, it's one of those forms of resistance in which being alive and being visible and being in the mainstream are themselves acts of transgression for a group which is supposed to kind of be invisible, offstage, and illegal. And yet the danger there is that in favor of kind of keeping visible and countering caste violence, there is the absence of a very kind of strict class ideology, or the absence of kind of guarding against, you know, incorporative politics, which could then lead to perpetuation of state power, capitalist power, creative economies power, etc. And this kind of made me think of the broader divide, you know, within the Indian left, which has concerned so many people, and it's still something that it's not something that's been resolved, which is basically the divide between, you know, anti-caste and anti-capitalist politics, you know, and that's been such a fundamental problem to solidarity. And so I was wondering if this is the kind of reading that you would want people to take away from the book, and then what would be kind of the ways that this book offers us to move past this impasse, if there is indeed this impasse.
Mm-hmm. Let me backtrack a bit. There's so much in what you said. I have to remind myself some of it. But I actually think that, so Janam's work, yes, it is about an anti-capitalist critique. But part of what I was trying to say is that, yes, their attention to caste as a result, caste oppression is, you know, not at all as sound as it could be. Although, but I don't think that they also have a critique of religious oppression. My issue with the critique of religious oppression is that they're often laughing at the enemy. They're laughing at the way in which the Hindu right instrumentalizes religion towards its own violent ends, thereby showing the collusion of corporate capitalism and the Hindu right. Now, that is crucial. That's a very crucial critique to lay out there. But I think in a context like India, if you're not going to take religion seriously as something more than a site of oppression, then we are very subject to missing that just as the left has a need for justice and has a conception of ethics and justice that often is not rooted in religion, those who are rooted in religion have a need for conception, have a need and conception of justice and ethics that is rooted in religion, that involves something higher than themselves, right? And I think that the left is just not very great with giving religion its due. So it's not that they critique, that they don't have a, that Janam doesn't have a critique of religious oppression. I just am not sure how well they do with understanding religion itself. And I say this hugely as an internal critique of myself, because I'm very much part of that. I'm very, very much part of that. I don't have a sense of how to think of ethics and social justice in relation to a religion that I'm rooted in. So this is a challenge to myself that I see reflected in Janam's work. If that makes sense. In terms of Buddhan theatre, yes, there's a assimilative kind of politics at work in their in what they're doing. But I would absolutely not say that it's not anti-capitalist. I would say it is anti-capitalist. Because of their trade in thieving. Now, even though they're trying to go from being seen as a criminal community to being seen as a creative community, that does not mean that they have ever denied or disavowed their history and their livelihoods in thieving. And that it was very interesting to me. It was interesting to me because this is a community that's very marginalized and very subject to all kinds of and constant police violence, constant police raids and so forth. It's interesting to me because they could easily disavow it, or just at least rhetorically, but they don't. They very much acknowledge it, and they even claim it. They talk about how it takes a certain skill, and you know that you have to kind of know performance in some ways in order to be a good thief. You know, so I think there is a disregard for private property in that sense, because it's attached to an understanding of state criminality and capitalism's criminality. And so I think there is a very different kind of anti-capitalism in that. Now, mainstream belonging has to do with citizenship, has to do with constitutional guarantees, which they don't have as DNTs, as denotified tribals. They do not have constitutional guarantees, which is something that they continue to fight for. Mainstream belonging then is, of course, aligned with the broader structure of a capitalist state and a caste state. But I don't think that by default means that they don't have a critique of capitalism. And I think that that's an important distinction to make. And with that said, for example, I want to go back to the point about how creative economy, you know, Janam is also making use of not indirect terms, but, you know, they're making use of the kinds of initiatives that are happening in the Indian context, in the NGO circles or in the cultural production circles or in the cultural sort of sector, in because of creative economy processes and policies and so forth, when they, you know, try to figure out what are the management best practices for theater companies, you know, and Janam becomes the last word on it, or not last word on it, but part of an important discussion on that. Or what ways can grassroots theater companies build capacity building, you know, this kind of language, this kind of vocabulary, and contributing to it based on their histories, I think is part of that. I also think that things like working class museums are part of that. Like, if so, they are not outside of that. And this is what I'm trying to do in the book, is to show that it is not quite so simple as saying this is an anti-capitalist critique, Janam is, and then this is an anti-caste critique, Buddhan Theatre is, and the twain shall meet. There are points of difference, very deep difference. There are points of connection, very solid connection. we need to recognize the complexity of both and why each makes the choices that each makes in the context of the uneven structures that they, like the uneven positions that they occupy within the structures of hierarchy and violence and inequality in the Indian context. Because if we don't have that kind of analysis of the very varied kinds of politics that we see around us on the left, then we are sort of not going to appreciate what can be learned from each context to build towards a broader whole. So I don't think it can be flattened as anti-caste versus anti-capitalist, because there is an anti-capitalist critique within the anti-caste. And it is actually less that, oh, this is a working class politics and that is a caste politics, so much as that is a caste politics that recognizes that no working class is without a caste. There is no conception of working class out there that is not rooted in some conception of caste. It might just be that the trade union kind of factory-based working class just simply doesn't foreground caste because it tends to be more dominant.
So it sounds like the impasses are less obvious, or less the ones that we would, you know, that would come to mind, obviously, and yet perhaps just as intractable and requiring analysis and effort to, if not overcome them, at least come to know them properly so that solidarity can become possible.
Yeah, I think I do believe that there is a need for solidarity. It's not that these troops don't work together on occasion. It's not that the other troops or other political organizations that would likewise work at loggerheads in some ways are also collaborating with each other at other points. But I think that the ways in which they differ, the ways in which there is the points of contention, the what remains intractable needs to not be treated in flat terms, because that amounts to a denial and a dismissal and, oh, it's just, that's just anti-class politics, as opposed to recognizing, well, actually, it's also working class politics. We just need to learn how to recognize a different way of thinking about working class too. You know, the Brahminical kind of left needs to think about what we associate with a working class politics and why Bhuvan Bhatta's politics does not strike us as a working class politics, if that makes sense. Like, how come it's not part of our ability to, you know, to see it as such? So I think those who've been in the position to label the dominant and organized left and to label the working class politics as such, we're the ones who need to do the work of rethinking what we have and have not been open to, and what we have and have not been able to see as a class politics.
Right. And what appears to be, cultural, and what appears to be structural in terms of oppression. Great. Thank you for that answer. I think this book has such, you know, important implications for understanding so many things, activism, not the least. But as we were talking before we started recording, you've come away since you wrote the book, you know, you've come forward in terms of your thinking and in terms of what you're working on now. You wrote this book in 2016. So where are you at intellectually, politically? What are you working on? And what are things that you, you know, have moved beyond what you thought before? And what are things that you think you were like exactly right about?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Aparna, because I think that even though, you know, for example, the last chapter of the book really does in some ways focus on Bhuvan Bhatta's experience of violence in the context of Gujarat, and it highlights the caste violence of the Patel and Sindhi communities to affect a certain kind of, and produce a certain kind of collaboration of Hindutva and capitalist power in that context. I really don't think that the book as a whole did enough to treat caste violence and caste power in structural terms. I think caste primarily in the book comes through as, you know, I'm studying a marginalized people who are affected by caste and colonial terms of violence, but I think the focus is mostly on what they are doing to address that rather than highlighting enough of the work that caste does to produce this violence. And so, I mean, I subsequently wrote a piece on called Eating Heritage, Caste Colonialism and Adivasi Creativity for the journal Cultural Studies, which came out recently. And in that, I'm trying to address some of that neglect and looking back on what makes this really primary, you know, how do we understand that relationship between caste and colonial violence? And I'm trying to address certain critiques that have come out by Anastasia Pilievsky, for example, who argues that, you know, we need to not think of criminal tribes as as a colonial invention. We need to go further back in the past. And that is super important. And I think that is a crucial thing because of this caste history. But part of the problem with her argument is that she's basically using that idea that criminal tribes is not a colonial invention to argue that really the activism of the middle class to that this kind of critique of criminal tribes as colonial invention is a invention of the middle class activists who are trying to uplift these, you know, denotified tribals. And I think that is a problem because I think that those who don't have constitutional guarantees don't have it because of the ways in which pre-colonial caste formations collaborated with or were consolidated by colonial administration and knowledge production. And so that has generated in the post-colonial casteist context an ongoing kind of violence. And to say that any critique of the criminal tribe work is sort of middle class activism that has inherited a colonial legacy of, you know, missionary upliftment and so forth, missionary work to uplift the poor and so forth. I think that really sort of, again, flattens what is going on. So I'm trying to work now on thinking more closely about the relationship of caste and colonialism. And however, I'm doing it in the context of South Asians in Canada as well, because I'm interested in thinking about complicity. And this is a newish kind of focus, not entirely new, but, you know, thinking in terms of our responsibility and our complicity in reproducing structures of caste and colonial violence. Because one of the things that we see around us in the North American context is that we South Asians circulate in the North American context as racialized people, but not as caste bearing caste power and privilege. And that erases some of, again, the relationship between caste and colonialism that explains our presence here and that explains how we relate to racial politics as well. And so it's much more focused on the North American context, but it is not disconnected from the challenge of thinking about the relationship of caste and colonialism.
Wonderful. That sounds great. I really look forward to, you know, following your work and seeing how it evolves. And it certainly has helped me as an activist and a scholar to, you know, really think hard about all these different relationships that are often flattened and to even examine things like affect and things that just pass unnoticed, to look closely at them in order to build a politics for justice. So thank you so much for writing this book and thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, Aparna. Thank you for inviting me to do this.